Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. There was some huge news last week. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, was freed from prison and is expected to bring to an end a decade-long saga with the US over the publication of military secrets in 2010. He stands to walk away a free man for time already spent incarcerated in the UK if he takes the guilty plea deal on the table. The big question for today is, what is the legacy that WikiLeaks leaves behind for investigative journalism, and what might be the precedent of this case? In a LinkedIn Live Q&A this week, I spoke about this with James Ball, who worked for 3 months on Cablegate, the publication of those 250,000 US embassy cables. He is now the first political editor of The New European, who has previously written for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and BuzzFeed. He played a key role in the Pulitzer Prize coverage of the NSA leaks by Edward Snowden, as well as the offshore leaks and the HSBC files. Stay tuned for more on his time working for WikiLeaks, where it went well, where it went wrong, and where we as an industry go from here. That conversation is coming up, so don't go anywhere. James, I suppose there's one place to start for me, which is WikiLeaks. Take us back to when you joined. I know you're only there for a short period of your career, but why did you want to work for them? What was it about their mission that really brought you in, and what was your involvement there?
It's sort of hard to remember now, but in 2010, WikiLeaks was really something revolutionary. We'd not seen a large sort of scale drop of classified documents really since about the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg, who had done that by photocopying a very long report and eventually managing to pass it to the Washington Post and New York Times. And then you'd gone decades without anything like it. And you also sort of had this culture in newsrooms where people would have their sources or they'd have a document and then they'd tell you about it, but you'd never see it. And that was okay. You had newsrooms who didn't really see the need for anyone with data skills, coding skills, visual skills, any of that stuff. And so WikiLeaks sort of comes along and starts getting noticed really around the financial crisis. And it's initially just posting data on the internet. You know, I'd encountered it in 2008 when it dropped the Icelandic banking files. And it was a sort of PowerPoint presentation. It wasn't revealing a whole bunch of detailed customer information or anything. But actually, it told you a lot about how these companies had, you know, the banks essentially, before they went bankrupt, managed to sort it out so that they kept their other companies solvent. And one thing that struck me when I'd done that is I was a journalist and I looked at them and I found essentially how, because I worked in this field at the time, Britain's biggest ready meal manufacturer was owned by the same people who owned one of the Icelandic banks, and they'd managed to sell the company to themselves so they didn't pay any debt. And I found it weird. I was the only journalist in the world who discovered this. It right. was because no one actually looked through these files when they were there. No one dug into it. And so seeing WikiLeaks in 2010 actually cotton onto this and work with mainstream journalists and reveal the stuff and actually have some journalism to tell you what it meant and to go in there and to enrich in it, it felt like something new, and that was really exciting.
Yeah, a real home for your skills. I mean, it seems, based on what you've said there, that you really enjoyed it from the very beginning. You really enjoyed your early time with WikiLeaks.
It was, I mean, the adrenaline of working on a story on that size is very hard to describe. There's all sorts of dramatic moments. There's all sorts of silly moments. You know, you are working incredibly long hours. I worked with WikiLeaks before I sort of worked for them. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism worked on the Iraq war logs, which was a very, very serious and horrifying often story. You know, it was 391,000 classified documents on ground level incidents in Iraq. This was the death of civilians, often at US hands. It was how the country disintegrated into civil war. And we were trying to turn that into an hour of dispatches at Al Jazeera. But that meant Assange would be wheeling around the office while you were working. You were sort of So you had this very silly, you know, at one point he wasn't wearing a shirt, but he was wearing a stab vest. And so it looked like a sort of almost a Borat style sort of tank that left his midriff exposed in a sweltering hot office. And you know, where you're like, no, why are you wearing a stab vest inside? You know, none of us even have knives, mate.
Well, at least it wasn't company uniform.
So, but you're working on this stuff that is so obviously important and matters, and you hope might change the debate. And you're working very hard. And because it's your whole life, you know, you're very absorbed in it one way or another. And so it's hard not to get swept along and to really sort of see the mission. Yeah. And, you know, I have been a very public critic of WikiLeaks for more than a decade. I still believe that the work that was done in partnership with the papers and with the mainstream in 2010 was hugely in the public interest and has been really significant. And so
you're talking about,
you know, I did the Cablegate files, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the Guantanamo personnel records. You know, there was some hugely significant stuff in there.
Well, take us to that moment, because, you know, what is it like to be part of such a large scale collaborative effort like that with all of these titans from around the media industry to be part of that publishing process?
I mean, what's quite funny is Julian would always want you to make WikiLeaks look as if it was this multi-billion sort of amazing organization. You know, we've got operatives around the world, we've got this, we've got that. It was sort of held together with spit, string and hope. You know, WikiLeaks had been about six people and five of them quit. You know, Assange, in any other situation, they'd have kicked Assange out, but Assange was by far the strongest personality. And so all of the people who'd been running WikiLeaks quit. And so it was essentially Assange and a bunch of people in their early 20s and Christian Claffensen, a sort of older Icelandic journalist. And so there's five or six of us, and we're having to sort of sit in with people like Alan Rusbridger, with very senior lawyers. And we sort of kept Julian off the table, and we're doing these negotiations about how we're going to time it, how it's going to work, what's going to publish. And there was this strange realization that the papers wanted to be one step behind WikiLeaks. They were sort of using us in their negotiations with the State Department or with the Department of Defense. They were saying, well, look, we're keeping these lunatics in line, so you may as well like cooperate with us, or else, you know what Julian Assange is like, he'll just publish it all online.
Right. But
we were sort of okay with that, because that helped give the papers and the editors the backbone to publish. But it was these sort of odd things where, you know, obviously I went on from WikiLeaks to join The Guardian, but we were negotiating with other things. And you'd see these very senior, experienced journalists going, why am I negotiating with this child? But
was there also a mismatch in the standards there, James, in terms of maybe how you redacted certain things, how you sifted through what was important?
So there were some very committed journalists at WikiLeaks, and some people who had quite strong ideologies, which gave them a misleading impression of what it meant to be named in the papers.
Right.
So, for example, if you are a working journalist in US foreign affairs, you will go out for drinks with people from the State Department or from the US embassy in the country you're posted in. That's your job. You're trying to find out things from them. They're trying to find out things from you. And so you're having a lovely chat. You're sort of swapping gossip. You're doing all of this stuff. And you go off to the loo and you write it all up on your phone. So you've got a note of it to use in stories. You know, it'll be off the record, but you've got to go, oh, I'm going to ask him about this. I'm going to, you know, the old run to the loo and write up your notes, by the way, for any incoming journalists, it's the best trick. Do it. But of course, the State Department person is doing exactly the same thing. They write it up in a memo the next day going, had lunch with this person. Here's what I learned. And that doesn't mean that you're an agent of the US government. That doesn't mean you're giving them intel or being paid or doing anything improper. And of course, they're talking to activists. They're talking to all sorts of other people who might have an interest in learning things from the State Department. But some people thought that meant if you're named in it and if you've talked to them, you are an agent of the US government and therefore you deserve to be named. And so you would hit some quite difficult barriers on who should and shouldn't be redacted and what it did and didn't mean to be named in these things. And so you had different viewpoints and different standards. But when WikiLeaks agreed to redact while it was cooperating with the papers, it was very much a position of pragmatism. You know, if this is what we have to do to keep the papers on side, this is what we'll do. It wasn't accepted as necessary to minimize harm, certainly by Julian. But that, I really should stress, that doesn't mean that no one at WikiLeaks cared about consequences, because a lot of them did. I think Julian cared less.
So what changed over time with that point of view internally with WikiLeaks? Did it get better? Did it get worse? What's your perspective?
For a while, things held together. I think while it was leading in the papers, while it was sort of all there, that worked. But of course, the story starts to move on. The papers sort of published about 500 of the cables. And then you're faced with, well, how do we get the other 249,500 out?
Yeah.
And the way to do it would have been very slowly, and to get people to sort of look in each one and see what needed redacting. And there were some very sensitive things that needed redacting. There were sort of incidents where people had identified, you know, the state had been working to identify opposition leaders in dictatorships to see if they could help them out or work with them if they were successful, or get them support from neighbours. But there were things as grim as, you know, victims of child trafficking named in there. And so childhood rape survivors, there's no reason to name them. Now, I don't think anyone in WikiLeaks went, I want to name these people. But putting things out without looking each one got tricky. And so there was a very convoluted row. And eventually WikiLeaks put them all out unredacted because they claimed they'd got loose on the internet and tried to blame a now retired editor at The Guardian for it. I think the reality is Assange had wanted to get them all out, had realized there was too big a job to do it responsibly, and so was looking for a way to do it and frame someone else. But the ethical problems with WikiLeaks went further. I think the big problem is Julian Assange tells lies. And one of the things was someone that he brought in turned out to be a guy called Israel Shamir.
Yeah.
And Israel Shamir had been given about 100,000 of the cables unredacted when almost no one had them. And I know that because I gave them to him. I didn't know who he was, but I was told, can you get those to him? And did. And that included all of Eastern Europe, all of Russia, Israel, and a couple of others. And he was photographed a couple of days later, leaving the Interior Ministry of Belarus, very close Putin ally, Europe's last dictatorship, really oppressive country that jails activists, that jails opposition figures. And the day after, Lukashenko, who's still the dictator there, started saying that WikiLeaks showed that the opposition was funded and supported by America, and he was going to reveal that. And activists were punished off it. And Assange, you know, Index on Censorship, a sort of free speech organization who'd been very friendly to WikiLeaks, got in touch and said, what's going on here? Can you, like, help us out? What's happened? And I wanted to kind of do a thing, go, well, this is horrible. We're going to investigate it. We'll make sure, you know, we'll find out what happened and make sure nothing could happen. And Assange instead put out a blanket denial saying he couldn't possibly have given them any cables because he never had any. And when you see someone lie about, you know, as far as I was concerned, that was about as gross a mistake as an organization like WikiLeaks could make. It was foul. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were just immediately lying about it. And it's like, well, this is everything that we're criticizing the US for. And we're smaller, we could be better, and we're not being. And so there was a real scales fall from the eyes moment.
Yeah. It seems to me what you said is there were red flags along the way, but this was probably the moment in time where you thought, you know, we've crossed the line and you probably wanted to leave after that point. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. The warning signs are always a lot clearer with hindsight. I mean, by the time you're at WikiLeaks, you've been told never to turn your phone on. You're in a house with other WikiLeaks people in the middle of nowhere. You are sort of essentially trying to work while being in something that's almost like the Big Brother house. You're sleep deprived. And it's a lot like being in a cult. You know, people afterwards kind of actually suggested that I went to sort of cult deprogramming type things, because everyone, the only people you're associating with are WikiLeaks people. The only thing you're doing is the task, and you get so focused on it, and it feels so important and so much of your life. It's so hard to disagree, and it's so hard to push away. Mm. So that was when I wanted to, but it took me weeks after it. And, you know, I think I'm quite a sort of stubborn-minded individual type.
I know you've told me this before. The US Department of Justice, when they were going after Assange, they asked you to testify, right? Can you expand on that?
Yes. I think it was, I mean, essentially I got a very polite first approach from a UK policeman who was sort of just, oh, you know, it'd be nice to chat. Why don't you just give me a quick call? And thankfully, I'm experienced enough to know when you get something like that, you call a lawyer. And we then had quite a lot of conversations with, and it essentially turned out the Met were acting as a conduit for the FBI, who were in turn acting as a conduit for the Department of Justice.
Right.
And we found out that they wanted to talk to me over the Israel Shamir stuff, because they wanted, ideally, for me to become a, quote, voluntary witness. But they did essentially, in various polite ways through my lawyer, suggest it would be in my best interests to be a voluntary witness. As my lawyers pointed out, there were various things I could have been prosecuted for in relation to WikiLeaks. You know, most of what Assange was prosecuted for, I could have been. And like Assange, I hadn't been working for a major news outlet when I did it. But also, I had said publicly that I handed documents to Israel Shamir, who we then think handed them to a dictator,
right?
Which is, you know, a more serious offence that may not look like journalism. There was also a very bizarre moment where the officer clearly thought they had some information on me, and my own lawyer tested me quite carefully on this, because essentially at the end of a long meeting, it was sort of suggested, oh, well, you know, we're working with a lot of the three-letter agencies, which is how they like to refer to NSA, CIA, you know, MI6. And of course, they've got all sorts of information. And you know, they've been looking up James Ball, and he doesn't seem to exist. Now, I'm sure he's got all sorts of good reasons to be writing under an assumed name. You know, investigative journalists, they might want to use a false name, but it might be useful if he knows that we know that's what he's doing. My name is very boring, has never changed, and yeah. I have a birth certificate with it on. This is not a pen name. Yeah. So it was voluntary, but not, didn't feel very voluntary. But to be fair to them, I mean, this dragged out for a year. It cost me thousands in legal fees, which is quite funny. My reputation on the internet is I hate Assange and I want to bring him down and all of this. I spent thousands of pounds of my own money to not testify against him.
That's what I'm wondering, why you didn't.
But, because I think Assange is a bad journalist. He may not even be a journalist. I think his ethics are bad. I don't think people should leak to him. I don't think you should go to jail for being an unethical journalist. I don't think the US should be the judge of this. And I think the prosecution against Julian Assange was wrong. And I think it is a threat to journalism across the world. No, Assange is an Australian citizen. The work he did on the Chelsea Manning leaks was done while he was in Iceland and the UK. He never set foot in America. And so an espionage prosecution against someone like him lets anyone working across the world know, if you are dealing with classified US matters, they may pursue you. And most people don't have Julian Assange's fame, the money he could raise. You know, he's not a rich man, but he had access to the very best of legal representation through crowdfunding, etc., and backers. And he had the profile so that, you know, his supporters might not feel the support was as enthusiastic as it could be. But you had people like Alan Rusbridger, people like Bill Keller, you know, the editors of major publications that worked with him, saying, even if you don't like him, this prosecution is wrong. Most journalists don't have that. And so, you know, you don't have to think Assange is a good man to think this was a bad case.
Later this year in November, there's a US presidential election happening. What do you think the precedent of this ruling will be, thinking about, you know, international journalism and their, you know, attention towards the US?
So, as I've said, I think there is this difficulty in that the successful prosecution, I mean, it's a success of sorts, getting Assange to plead guilty, to do a plea deal, and very visibly have spent 5 years in prison and years before that in sort of in the embassy. You can say that's self-imposed or not. It's obvious it's come at a significant cost. And Assange wasn't the whistleblower himself, wasn't the source himself. He was someone involved in the publication. So there is a chilling effect on that. Now, it doesn't play easily into US politics. This case was actually brought by the Trump DOJ. You know, Donald Trump was the president when this criminal case was unsealed, and it was continued under Joe Biden. Interestingly, under Barack Obama, the Department of Justice specifically refused to pursue Assange on charges like these because they said the same charges could be used against the New York Times in future, and they didn't want to set that precedent. So the Obama Department of Justice saw the risk to journalism in exactly what the Trump DOJ began and the Biden one finished. So on that level, it's just straightforwardly a threat to media freedom in the US and beyond it. In terms of sort of Assange personally in US politics, well, he did actually involve himself in the 2016 election in ways that were very helpful to Trump and were coordinated with the Trump campaign. Russian military hackers got hold of information from the Democratic National Committee and from John Podesta's emails, and WikiLeaks published both, coordinating timing with the Trump campaign to help cover up the grab and by the pussy, sorry for the language, tape. There's not really a way to refer to it without saying it. And you know, I don't think any of that's journalistic. I don't think any of that's high-minded. So Assange has got no reason to owe either of these men favours. You know, if he was hoping Trump would help him, and he clearly was, if you look at the DM communications between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks, they were suggesting all sorts of things the US could do to help get Assange out of the embassy if Trump got in, and instead Trump prosecuted him. So he doesn't owe anyone favours here, but, you know, you never quite know what Julian will do, and it's possible that, you know, he actually is going to want to take some time for himself. He's had a very, very difficult sort of 12 years.
Yeah. I mean, you've written that you think this is a pointless prosecution in many ways. Can you elaborate on why you think that is?
I think if the US was going to pursue Assange as aggressively as they did, the justification you'd hear behind closed doors is, well, look at all the more dangerous things he's done afterwards. He actually released the code of CIA hacking tools. Now, when you release the code of a hacking tool, you're essentially putting that into anyone's hands. You're giving them a digital weapon. And criminal hacking gangs and potentially nation-state hacking gangs used that code to cause damage in huge scale in companies and to people across the world. That is nothing to do with journalism. Whether or not Assange knew the 2016 material originated from Russia and from the nation state, the way he was using it to try and help his own case looks a lot more like sort of dirty bargaining of sort of, you know, smear campaign stuff than like journalism. If they wanted to bring charges on that stuff, they should have brought charges on that stuff. What they would argue is they were trying to get the extradition on this 2010 case, and then they'd bring more serious charges with evidence they had behind closed doors. By taking this plea deal, they get rid of that. What it looks like is that the most powerful state in the world has just mounted a vendetta against someone who made them look bad. And they knew that they couldn't go for the big publications, so they went for the most exposed person. It's not good when you're the most powerful state in the world to look either petty or vindictive. So both at the same time is quite bad.
Yeah. Question come in for you here, James. Scrutinizing the US defense sector is still important, probably more than ever. What advice would you give reporters undertaking new investigations?
So, I mean, be careful. I think part of it is if you pursue with honest inquiry in your mind, you are a lot more protected than if you're trying to prove a thesis. If you just start from X was a cover-up or X did a bad thing, you tend to not be doing good journalism. You're trying to fulfill a hunch, or you're trying to fulfill a conspiracy even. If you sort of have questions about something, start with what you know, start with what you can find out, and build outwards from that. Build from the outside in, you know, who's open door on it? You know, is there a think tank that's related in it? Can you ask them some questions and then ask them who to talk to? You know, don't approach who might be the most sensitive source straight away. Work at easy sources, then less through them get to know less easy sources and work in like that. If you're soliciting documents, make sure that you know your digital security inside out and back to front. Mm. And don't ask for them for their own sake. You know, say if you work in defense, if you work in intelligence and you're alarmed by what you see, then get in touch. You know, you're not saying, please leak anything classified to me. Because one of those is responsible journalism and the other could be used to suggest you're being reckless and trying to sort of provoke people to damage security. But I think the more that you actually pursue public interest inquiry, the better your story will be, the more factually sort of grounded it'll be and the better the impact will be, but also the more protected you are.
And what if presented with leaked information, James, when you can't be sure how it's been sourced, how the method of which it's been sourced? What's your general view on how to approach that situation?
So the first thing you should do is try and interrogate your source. You should try and look at who might have given this to me. Why might they have given to me? How do I know it's real? How can I authenticate it? And sort of work on all of that. If you get relatively sure that what you have is real, even if you don't know the source, you're then best to sort of think, what's the reasons to look in this? What might be in this? You are usually, especially if it's classified, you are technically committing a criminal offence just looking at it.
Right.
So you need a public interest justification for why you've looked in it. Now, this is a much lower bar than publishing it, but essentially, you know, This is also true for company data. If it's confidential, if it's, you know, trade secrets, if it's protected, you could be committing offences to look at that as well. So what's your reason for looking at it? Does a source that you actually know the name of, have they suggested what the wrongdoing in it is? You know, is there, you know, if or have there been public allegations that there's something in this data and in this database that might be there? That's usually a test you can pass. That, you know, I don't think I've ever actually had a big serious data set and gone, I'm not even looking at it. But if you do that first, you can show that you're considering at every stage what to do. Yeah. If you look in it and decide there's a story there and you've verified the documents and you've done the rest of it, you then have to go, well, what's the potential harm of publishing this? And what's the public interest in what it reveals? And so with the Edward Snowden documents, Snowden had said he didn't want us just publishing stuff that was interesting in it, because there was loads of interesting stuff, including some that might have passed a public interest test. He said, I'm giving this to talk about the surveillance state and surveillance practices. And we have followed that rule. So we only published documents that related to potential surveillance overreach, and we only published enough to evidence our work. And so we looked at loads of interesting stuff, but we only published the tiniest fraction that we thought passed quite a vigorous test. And so that process is what protects you and what sort of makes sure that you're not just turning into a sort of online hacker who's dumping loads of stuff online and violating lots of people's privacy, maybe doing harm and maybe getting locked up.
Fascinating. I mean, we're nearly out of time here, James, but a quick fire question for you. What will Julian Assange do next?
Oh, there's a big question. I think he would be a better champion and figurehead of sort of transparency causes, of free speech causes, of freedom for journalists, etc., than he would be someone running a whistleblowing website. I think everyone knows who he is. All the intelligence agencies know where he is. And so I think his sources would be in a lot of trouble. I suspect he'll be more minded to try and do something like WikiLeaks again, but who knows? And look, the guy has had a real ordeal over the last decade. If he decides he'd rather have the quiet life now, he's earned it. But that's the one thing I don't think he'll do.
Yeah. It's ironic, isn't it? I mean, we've spoken a lot today about how kind of difficult he is to work with, but I suppose one of the things he'll be remembered by, and indeed the legacy of the WikiLeaks, is that, you know, the collaborative aspect of investigative journalism sort of endures at this point in time. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah. Investigative journalists used to sort of cooperate about as well as cats in a sack. And now it's the name of the game, you know, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, where I worked for 5 years quite recently. It's built in its DNA. It never publishes without collaborating. The Guardian and New York Times have collaborated many times again. ICIJ has got coalitions of 70, 80, 100 publications on global leaks. It's a better culture. It's better for accountability. And it's kind of amazing that one of the most difficult men sort of in 21st century media has been the catalyst to make that happen. And he does deserve some credit for that, even if it wasn't necessarily deliberate.
So what did we learn today? I think the lesson is this. Responsible journalism takes time, and you cannot afford to be impatient. We have seen the measures that the US went to pursue Assange, a saga that has been drawn out for 14 years, and the real toll that has had on him. It's a reminder of why ethical journalism is needed, as sources and journalists alike both can be compromised in whistleblowing. Working together isn't such a bad idea. It's one of the ironic legacies of Julian Assange that collaborative journalism is still alive and kicking thanks to him, even if people only did it to keep him on a leash. What did you learn, though, and what's your perspective? Let me know on jacob@journalism.co.uk. I'm also on LinkedIn and X. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.